This week, the heads of five major drug distribution companies testified before Congress about their role in the nation's opioid crisis. Here's Cardinal Health CEO George Barrett on CBS News.
With the benefit of hindsight, I wish we had moved faster and asked a different set of questions.
We hear from an Illinois man who battled opioid addiction and the doctor helping him. Since 2004, nine vector-borne diseases were discovered or introduced for the first time in the U.S. What's responsible? What can you do to protect yourself from mosquito, flea, and tick diseases this summer? But first,
there's an enormous drop, 36% drop, in people feeling bullied and getting derogatory remarks made about them when they're included in the curriculum.
That's Democratic State Senator Heather Staines speaking on the floor about a bill that passed the Senate last week. It would require that LGBT historical figures become part of history classes in Illinois public schools. The senator joins us. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you think back to what you learned in history class growing up, there are probably a few big names that come to mind. Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr., John F. Kennedy, among others. Now, kids in Illinois public schools could also soon be learning about the achievement of LGBT pioneers like Harvey Milk. That's part of the idea behind a new Illinois Senate bill that would require Illinois public school history courses to devote some time to covering the contributions of LGBT historical figures. Local school districts would still set the curriculum and have control over specific subject matter. We're going to be speaking to a couple different perspectives on this issue. Let's start with Brian Johnson, who's Chief Executive Officer of Equality Illinois. He's on the line from Chicago. Hi, Brian. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
Brian, I wonder, from your perspective with Equality Illinois, if you could share why you think curriculum like this is important in Illinois public schools.
Yeah, we think it's important on two fronts. First, we think it's important for LGBTQ youth to see themselves represented in history. You know, when I was a young teenager and a young man growing up in public schools in Virginia, I did not know that there were so many great LGBTQ Americans who had done wonderful things for our country. I didn't know that Jane Addams was a lesbian. I didn't know about James Baldwin. I didn't know about Bayard Rustin, the organizer for the March on Washington. And had I known that, I think I would have had a greater sense of who I might aspire to be. And so I think for LGBTQ youth, it's particularly important. But honestly, Nyla, even for non-LGBTQ youth, to know that there is such a diversity of Americans who have contributed to our society in so many different ways, we think helps Illinois youth to become better citizens and more productive adults, being able to appreciate the wide variety of differences that exist in our state.
So for you, it's not just about representation. It sounds like education as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when we talk about Martin Luther King Jr., as you allude to, we mention Coretta Scott King. When we talk about Abraham Lincoln, we talk about Mary Todd Lincoln. We just want the same types of education to be happening that when we talk about Jane Addams, we talk about her long-term partner, Mary Rosette Smith.
And do you feel like there's part of history, as you're saying, there were people who we learn about in history and maybe we didn't know that they were gay or lesbian? Do you feel like that's also something, it's part of a narrative that you think should be uncovered as part of history, too, it sounds like?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the more we know about various people in history and who they are, the types of families that they had, the more that we should be teaching our young people about the diversity of families and individuals that have made up, you know, our great state over time.
I've also seen some data about the difference that this curriculum makes in terms of bullying and students, the number of students who felt like they were bullied when curriculum has been taught in LGBT schools. Is that something that you have seen or heard a little bit about?
We have. I mean, there are some early studies. This is still relatively new, but there are some early studies that show that rates of verbal and physical assault do go down when young people are taught about LGBTQ people in positive ways. I mean, if you can imagine, if the only thing you're hearing about LGBTQ people is that they exist only in bedrooms and bathrooms and are terrible drains on our society's moral fabric, you're going to draw one set of conclusions. But on the other hand, if you have a counter narrative grounded in fact that there were these great Illinoisans, Frances Willard, Jane Addams, great Americans. You as a young person are going to be able to develop a broader appreciation for your classmates and for even more people in our state.
Brian, who's Frances Willard? Can you tell us about that? I don't know who he is.
Yeah, no, she was one of the great social justice activists in the 19th century. She was the head of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. She is from Evanston, and it was uncovered in her diaries just a few decades ago that she had deep romantic relationships with women early in her life.
Oh, interesting history. Thank you for being with us. Brian Johnson is the CEO of Equality Illinois on the line from Chicago. Brian, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla. Great to talk to you.
We are talking about a bill that passed the Illinois Senate last week that would require Illinois public schools to teach about the accomplishment of LGBT individuals in their history textbooks. I'd like to welcome someone else to the conversation now. Zach Messersmith is Director of Government Relations for the Illinois Association of School Boards. It's a nonprofit that represents some local education boards. He's on the line from Springfield. Hi, Zach. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me on.
Zach, what are your thoughts about the bill?
Yeah, so my thoughts about the bill aren't so much about the content of the bill. It is more that we represent a local control, or we represent a local organization that believes in local control, and we have a clear directive from our membership to oppose all curricular mandates that come before the General Assembly. It's our belief that locally elected school boards should be able to determine curricula for their students as long as it meets the Illinois Learning Standards.
And so in the bill, as I understand it, local school districts will still get to set the curriculum. To your mind, that's not a sufficient enough reason to support this bill.
Yeah, there are obviously flexibilities in the bill, and it is much improved from when it was introduced originally to the General Assembly. And I definitely see that and appreciate the changes that have gone into this bill. However, what I would say is that the structure of the Illinois Learning Standards allow for this type of LGBT history to be taught now without requiring the state mandate. Specifically, the history learning standards say that schools should identify the roles of individual groups and all institutions and people that struggle for safety, freedom, equality, and justice. So in our opinion, we don't need another state mandate on schools to teach this. It's already in the Illinois Learning Standards.
Okay, so to your mind, you think this is unnecessary?
Absolutely. Local school districts have that ability to teach it now, and we think that the conversation needs to be had locally. It's not that I think it's unnecessary. I think that is not the terminology I would use. It's not necessary for it to be determined at the state level that this needs to be taught. It can be done and decided locally.
Thanks for clarifying that. I appreciate that. That's Zach Messersmith. He is Director of Government Relations for the Illinois Association of School Boards on the line from Springfield. Zach, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
As we talk about this bill, we wanted to speak to the sponsor of the bill. State Senator Heather Staines is a Democrat. She represents Illinois' 7th District, which includes parts of the north side of Chicago, Rogers Park, Edgewater. She's on the line now, I believe, from Springfield. Senator Staines, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So to Zach's point that he was just making about the fact that this is already a part of an encouraged curriculum across Illinois, do we know how many schools are adopting this curriculum already?
I don't know the number of schools that are doing that. What I do know when there was a survey done of kids is that it drops significantly if the school is providing affirmative information about gay, lesbian population over history, that 40% drop in how the LGBT students there feel in terms of safety, that they're getting less harassed, less bullied when it is available. Don't know the numbers of the schools in which that's the case, but there's clear early information that it really does make a difference to the safety that the kids feel.
And so that for you is the impetus behind this. This is why you think this is an important piece of legislation.
Exactly. And, you know, we do have it right now. I mean, I understand the viewpoint about not wanting more mandates, but, you know, currently that's why, and we really did work to make this as flexible in terms of how to implement it as possible for school districts so they can incorporate it wherever they think it works most easily and to the extent that they want to. There's not any requirements in terms of how much time or anything like that. So it's very flexible, and it's just including it in the whole section of our law, which already says you should be studying African-American history, people with disabilities, all sorts of different protected groups. This is one more group that's now included in that, and I think appropriately so.
And so, Senator Staines, if students, so it sounds like this is it a suggestion or is it a requirement for school districts?
Well, it's a requirement now, but that we did, there's always the ability for a local school district to get a waiver for any mandate. That was passed last session, being able to do that. So a school district that wants to can seek a waiver, just like they can for any mandate. But it is now a mandate requiring that this is something that you incorporate into your curriculum. But there, as I say, there's great flexibility in how and when you do so.
And how so? And then so that in terms of implementation, it would be, just as you said, a recommendation that this happen. And then it would be up to individual school districts to determine the curriculum.
That is correct.
And in terms of resources for how schools would do that, are there suggestions for that? Or what? I wonder what advice you have for school districts on that front.
Yeah, there's definitely places that people can go. There's textbooks out there. There's kids books if you want to try to do it, you know, fifth grade or whatever grade you want. There's also the Legacy Project that's based in Chicago that provides a lot of curricular ideas online. So there are lots of resources that are available out there to help schools incorporate this into their curriculum.
I mentioned Harvey Milk, one of the first openly gay elected officials in the U.S. who was assassinated in California. We heard Brian Johnson talking about Frances Willard and Jane Addams. Who else are you hoping would be highlighted in schools, in history classrooms, if this bill were to become law?
Well, you know, there's just many people, and that's the surprise. I was at the Chicago History Awards when the first LGBTQ person received the Jane Addams Award, for example, with a man by the name of Art Johnston. And he spoke eloquently about the fact that he was so honored to be there getting a history award because, you know, history of gays and lesbians is so written out of, you know, it just isn't there in our history. It's sort of been erased. And even Jane Addams herself, under whose name he was getting that award, is a lesbian. And, you know, very few people know that. You know, you can talk about Alan Turing, what happened to him, and sort of he was in large part of one of the fathers of computer science. I'm not sure, you know, people may know some of that. They may not. When you talk about Rustin, for example, who was a big advocate on racial equality, working with Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., not sure people always know that he himself was gay. There's just many instances of this, and it matters a lot to kids growing up to see themselves in that history. And when you have a curriculum that affirms that, it's shown that it really can help reduce bullying and negative stereotypes associated with the LGBT population.
Right. That's Bayard Rustin that you're talking about, right?
Bayard Rustin.
Right.
Yep.
Senator Staines, apart from preventing bullying, which is certainly something I don't think anyone can really take issue with, why else do you think this curriculum is important?
We should, you know, facts are facts. Historical facts that somebody, whoever their spouse partner was for lifelong, is just part of the history books. But in the case of people who are LGBT, frequently that history just isn't included, isn't discussed. I think it's important to just make sure that that is part of the narrative when it's an historical fact.
And I mentioned that this is a Senate bill
3249.
Yeah. And this passed the Senate last week. What's the schedule?
Bipartisan support. Yes. Which is great.
And what do you expect next when this will go to the House?
Well, it's at the House now. And so now Anna Mueller is the House sponsor of it, and it needs to get through a committee and onto the floor there for a vote. Session ends at the end of May. So it'll be over the next couple of weeks, which we'll know whether it gets traction and is able to pass the House.
And so it sounds like you're working on having the votes in the House to pass this.
Absolutely. And certainly hope it does. I mean, we had bipartisan support, as I said, certainly hoping that's the case there in the House as well, and that it does continue to move forward. You know, we had a nice roll call here, so I'm hoping that helps them pass it in the House.
And are you optimistic, or what are your thoughts about whether or not Governor Rauner would sign this into law?
You know, Governor Rauner has, to my knowledge, been, you know, supportive to date on a lot of these kinds of bills that have been affirming to the LGBT population. I don't know where he will be. We have not talked to the administration, so I don't know his position on this, but certainly hope it would get careful consideration and hopefully his signature. But I do not know that. We have not gotten any confirmation on that one way or another.
That's State Senator Heather Staines. She's a Democrat representing Illinois' 7th District, which includes parts of north side of Chicago, Rogers Park and the Edgewater neighborhoods. Senator Staines, while I have you on the line here, can I just ask you, as you mentioned that May 31st deadline, also lots of people having questions about the budget process. I just wanted to ask you where the Senate's at with that, what's been going on the past 2 days, how you're feeling about the budget process.
You know, I'm optimistic. In fact, just to get on the call with you, I just left a budget meeting with some of my Republican colleagues as well as Democratic colleagues. We're having good conversations, I think frank conversations. I don't think anybody wants to be in a position where we don't have a budget again. It was horrible. The budget impasse was just devastating for the state of Illinois. I think there's widespread support for not having us go back to that budget stalemate again. So I remain optimistic that we will have a budget by May 31st.
Sounds like a very different picture than last year at this time, at least.
That's certainly my hope.
That's State Senator Heather Staines joining us to talk about her Senate bill, 3249, which would require Illinois public schools to teach about the accomplishments of LGBT individuals in history books, also giving us a little bit of a budget update. Senator, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Earlier this week, the country's major drug distributors testified before Congress about their role in our nation's opioid crisis, or what President Trump called earlier this year a public health emergency. Here's the chairman of that panel, Representative Greg Harper. He's a Republican from Mississippi, asking the five different drug company executives who were testifying whether they'd accept responsibility for their role in this crisis.
Do you believe that the actions that you or your company took contributed to the opioid epidemic, Mr. Barrett?
No, sir, I do not believe that we contributed to the opioid crisis.
Dr. Mastandrea?
Yes.
Mr. Hammergren?
No.
Mr. Smith?
I believe H.D. Smith conducted itself responsibly and discharged its obligations.
Is that a no?
Yes and no.
That audio courtesy of CBS News. Here in Illinois, many people were listening to that hearing, also looking for answers, including two of my next guests. Dr. Thomas Britton is the CEO of the Gateway Foundation. It's one of the largest nonprofit treatment centers in the state. Also on the line with us from the northwest suburbs of Chicago is Nick, a recovering opioid addict. He's asked that we just use his first name. Nick, Dr. Britton, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Good morning.
Nick, I wonder if we could start with you. I'm interested in your reaction to what we just heard and the role of pharmaceutical companies in a minute. But if you don't mind, I wanted to just start by hearing a little bit about your story. Can you tell us about how you first started using opioids?
Yeah, so it started probably later in high school. I was, you know, I smoked weed and I drank pretty frequently, like on the weekends, but, you know, once you kind of open that door, I was more subjected to taking pills and started off with like Xanax, especially that's a big thing going on too, but I found myself doing Vicodin, and then from Vicodin I really enjoyed that and got connected with people that had a supply of that, people who worked at pharmacies, and I was more subjected to taking like OxyContin, Dilaudid, and started to pick up from there, and from there then I started to, wanted to use more opiates because there wasn't enough for me to get, from that person. I would be able to get from dealers on the street.
Was it hard to get? How hard when you first started?
When I first started, it wasn't really honestly that challenging. I wasn't really thinking about it, but once it was kind of put into play, I was able to, use my clout at school and kind of figured out like, who's got what, and then from there I just got connected with people who were able to supply stronger stuff because everybody's trying to make money, I believe, honestly. So as soon as they find out that I'm buying, and then once I'm hooked, it's easier for them to keep coming back to me.
Hmm. And how much money was this? I mean, in the beginning, was it that expensive?
In the beginning, it wasn't as expensive because I wasn't using it nearly as much as I was using when I was in like full blown addiction. It was kind of like a weekend thing, maybe like $5-$20. It depends on how many I was buying, but I frequently started to like it more, and so I was purchasing it more. So I mean, of course, with more, I became more, I had a higher tolerance, so I needed to buy more. So by the end, you're spending upwards to like $50 to $100 a day.
Wow. And and you were in high school at the time, and I imagine at that time you didn't have any effect on, you didn't have any idea of the effect it was actually having on your brain chemistry and the age that you were at and those sorts of things, did you?
No, I did not.
And how many years were you sort of in, as you were saying, in that place where you were really spending a lot and really in the throes of this addiction?
So this all started back when I was 17. I'm 26 now, but I ended up getting sober at 24. So from 17 to 24, there was definitely a lot of opiate use in between all that time. But for the full daily amount, it took about maybe like 2 years, so probably when I was like 19. From 19 to 24.
And how would you say it affected your life?
Oh, I mean, it destroyed everything. I wasn't the greatest student. I won't say that. It destroyed my education. I was going to community college and I was trying my best, but ultimately when I started to use opioids, it really just took a lot from me. A lot of my friends, I started to steal. I started to become the person I never thought I would become. I became subjected to stealing. I was a liar. I would, whatever it took to get what I needed, that's, that was my main priority. Everything else, like survival mode, opiates was at the top. Like I needed that to survive. So, I mean, anybody or anything that got in the way, it didn't really matter. So, I mean, I ended up becoming homeless for some time. My family didn't want anything else to do with me. Once I got into stronger opiates, I overdosed probably 8 or 9 times. So, I mean, I really struggled for a long time until I had some serious consequences. I was, more subjected to trying to find recovery.
And how did you get connected with the Gateway Foundation?
Honestly, I mean, it was like, I think I just Googled it, and that was like the first one that popped up. I know I've heard good things from their Lake Villa, from other people, I believe. People, recommended it to me. But, I mean, at that point, I was just like, I went there a time before, and I had a good experience. I didn't stay sober. I was still kind of trying to hold on to the idea that, it was just the opiates, not drinking, and then, I found myself back doing the same stuff. But, I had a good experience the first time, so I went back, and then I got on board with what they were telling me.
We're talking to Nick about his experience, and the CEO of the Gateway Foundation is also on the line with us, Dr. Thomas Britton. Dr. Britton, I wonder, when you think about the Gateway Foundation and the different types of substance abuse and other treatment that you all provide, how much of the treatment that you're providing is primarily for people who are having problems with opioid use?
That's a great question. We've seen the trend of that change so dramatically just over the past 5 years. So if we were to snap back 10 years ago, 5 to 10% of the people that we supported had opiates as one of their primary drugs. And at a lot of the facilities that we treat today, it's as high as 60%. So, for example, in Springfield, it's one of the higher areas. Chicago, it's one of the higher areas. And that's really required programs like the Gateway Foundation to use newer interventions to help people with the cravings, the withdrawal, and the overall treatment.
And is Nick's story, I mean, that's such a huge number, 60%. Is Nick's story pretty common in terms of what you hear from folks coming in?
It's a very, very common story. It's important for us to step back and understand that in the country currently, there's an estimated 27 million people that require treatment for substance use disorders, and 66 million drank in a binge fashion in the last 30 days. So there's this massive problem with all substances. Opiates is one of the smaller as a whole out of that. However, the consequences are so much faster and more intense. You know, we had 65,000 people in this country die last year from overdose. It's more people than died in the entire Vietnam War. So if we think about the prescription drugs themselves, there was a massive overprescribing. One of the highest numbers at one point was there was enough prescriptions on the street for every American to have a 30-day supply. And that was when it was really in its heyday. And 80% of the people that ended up using heroin started on prescription drugs.
And to that point, and to the audio that I played at the beginning of this conversation of the federal congressional testimony that happened earlier this week of pharmaceutical companies and their role in particular, a lot of the focus was on West Virginia. I wonder what you would say about pharmaceuticals companies' role in all of this, especially here in Illinois.
I can't speak to specific companies. I think that it came down to really three primary areas. So one of them is that there's an inherent conflict between sales and marketing of a product and the impact on public health. And so there was a massive push to prescribe certain drugs. OxyContin, for example, one of the most prevalent that has already had settlements, has a $1 billion lawsuit on the table now, has made over $3 billion on prescribing the drug. And so clearly that is a part of the problem. I think that also at the same time, prescribers did not have enough education and understanding about the addiction potential of these medications. And finally, we didn't have a monitoring system in place that was strong enough to be able to tell if I went to six different pharmacies in the same day to get medications. And so I think this is a very complex issue. But, you know, the bottom line in the brain is that every single person has the potential to become addicted. It only depends on how much I use and for how long. And so with prescription drugs, if I had a hip condition and I took prescription drugs for 90 days or 6 months, if I'd never had the potential to develop addiction from any other behavior I had, suddenly I could.
And Dr. Britton, do you feel like there are enough controls in place now? As you mentioned, it's a complex issue, but in terms of prescribing and the ability to get prescription medication, first of all, do you think that there's sufficient controls in place?
I think it is a lot better than it was, but I think it has roads to come. You know, there is without question awareness in the prescribing world. You know, the previous Surgeon General made it one of his personal agendas to educate and train physicians on the risks and consequence of overprescribing. And I think we've made a lot of progress there. There's currently not a lifetime active prescription monitoring program in every state, and there's not good tracking over state lines. And so I think that if we were to think about the biggest places to target, you know, I think there's three. One is continued medical professional education. Two is prescription monitoring to make sure that people are not getting more than they should. And then the third is really continued intervention from a treatment standpoint to help the people that are already there.
And from a treatment standpoint, Nick, I wanted to bring up something that you mentioned. You mentioned that you'd had one experience with Gateway Foundation before you went back and were able to maintain your sobriety. Dr. Britton, on average, when people are addicted to opioids, how many cycles of treatment or recovery are there normally before it can be people can have more sustained success?
Well, you know, there's really quite a range on that, and there's a lot of factors that influence it. What we know is that this is a brain disease. It's not an issue of moral failing or willpower. And so, you know, the hard part is that I know the cure. I really do. But our payer system is not equipped and currently acting in a model that gives people the treatment that they require. So we know that 80% of people are successful if they have a year of active engagement. And most insurance companies and public insurers give you 30 to 60 days. And so to answer your question, it really depends on the level of care that I receive and the quality of the treatment provider. So Gateway Foundation, for example, integrates addiction medicine, which is a huge intervention to help people with opiate use disorders to have a bridge until they can build personal recovery like Nick has.
Nick, as you listen to the congressional testimony this week, and in particular, I'm just thinking of the audio we played of some of the executives accepting responsibility and expressing remorse, others not. What were you thinking when you were listening to that?
When I was listening to that, I honestly was thinking about that a lot of people play a role in, like, their part in this. You know, I think I heard a doctor speak just pretty recently. He was mentioning that they had, like, a survey system, and, you know, hospitals want a good, you know, review system. So people would write difficult reviews, and people are, you know, pain is subjective. So they would have to help prescribe these medications just to get a better review. I mean, you know, it's not something that they wanted to do personally, but it's just something that they had to do. And I think maybe there's money being influenced somewhere else. I'm not really entirely sure, but I don't think even that, like, for myself, there was not enough kind of like for health class, you know, like, hey, this is something you should be aware of. And I don't think there was enough, you know, that going on when I was in high school or anything like that. So I didn't really know too much about it. I was just kind of like, hey, I like what marijuana and drinking did, you know, so why wouldn't I not enjoy this? So I think there's a big role that everybody plays a part into. But I definitely think that it is a little bit too easy to be obtained. So I think definitely they play a role. I'm not going to say the entire fault's on them personally, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Dr. Britton, I wanted to ask you about a new facility that the Gateway Foundation is opening in Jacksonville in Morgan County, just west of Springfield. It's actually the same building as the Well Center, which closed because of the state budget crisis. What's your plans for this new facility?
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. One of the, you know, Gateway celebrates its 50th year this year, and from our inception, our commitment to the state of Illinois has been to find gaps in services and try to bring services to those in need. And when we learned that Morgan County was going to lose the Well Center, we stepped up to support that and have taken over the property, and we're under a significant reconstruction right now, so that what we will open end of May or June is a comprehensive treatment recovery home program that has residential treatment for men, which is a very high level of care. It will have longer-term recovery home beds, which is really a bridge to get back into society successfully. It will have outpatient care, and it will have opiate-based specific programming to help those people suffering from opiate disorders.
And are you concerned about what the landscape looks like for treatment across Illinois, particularly outside of Chicago, given the impacts of the two-year budget impasse?
Of course. You know, the bottom line is that the state of Illinois is in a financial crisis. And, you know, if our personal homes are in crisis or anything like that, we have to prioritize what we can spend money on and can't. And we have seen over the last 25 years, the federal support of treatment has gotten smaller and smaller, putting the burden on state, city, and county. And so I do worry about that. And as, you know, the state talks about their budget and prioritizes what it is, I think one of the considerations is what is the short and the long-term cost. So I might be able to save $1 million this year on substance use treatment, but it will cost me $10 million and then $20 million and then $30 million. We understand that in the Surgeon General's report, for example, he said that the cost of addiction to the country was $450 billion, and I've seen numbers as high as $1 trillion. And so my encouragement to the state when I talk to them and when I testify is we need to be thinking about the long game, not the short game.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're just going to wrap up this conversation with a couple more questions to Nick and to Dr. Thomas Britton, CEO of the Gateway Foundation. We've been talking about this new treatment facility that's going to be opening, as he said, later this summer in Jacksonville. That's just west of Springfield. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We're going to pick up this conversation just on the other side of this short break. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the opioid crisis, the public health emergency, as President Trump has called it, here in not just across the country, but in Illinois. My guests are Dr. Thomas Britton. He's the CEO of the Gateway Foundation. And Nick, both of them on the line from Chicago. Nick has been sharing his story of how he has been recovering from his opioid addiction. Nick, I wanted to just ask you about you were eventually, as you've shared your story with us, able to get treatment. And I wonder if you can maybe help some people understand who haven't been through this. Would you consider your recovery process? Is there like a day or a time you could point to where you thought, I'm okay right now? I'm going to be okay. I'm sober, really?
So personally, my story and my experience was I needed to get off the road and I needed to get into Gateway and I needed to get into treatment because my best thinking was just going to lead me back to more opiate use or drinking or whatever I can get my hands on. When I was able to kind of get a little bit of that 28-30-day program, I had to be put into like a sober living, a recovery home. And from there, I started to work, you know, an AA program. I was able to open my mind and actually listen to what people were offering me and on different programs like dual diagnose meetings and stuff where it's like more hands-on where we're with a lot of young people playing sports or whatever, just kind of getting more acclimated that there is fun in sobriety and that there's a lot of different options and I don't have to put myself underneath like a Gateway alumni program. But I just really needed to, I don't know, kind of see that there was something else out there besides just drinking and drugging. And, you know, I had to be open-minded and willing to actually do it because it's not going to happen, you know, just sitting on the couch. I had to actually ask for help and have people guide me through that process. Otherwise, you know, those first few attempts where I tried getting sober, I wasn't really willing to listen or take in any consideration of what people were offering me. I was still stuck on the idea that I could use and drink properly like that one, maybe just on weekends and stuff like that. I had to have my own experience where I had to beat myself up pretty much. Unfortunately, that's what I had to do to get where I needed to be.
Hmm. Dr. Britton, obviously this is a complex issue, especially when we're talking about addiction. There's so many misconceptions and stereotypes about this. What do you want people to know about this issue?
That's a great question. I think where I would start is that without any doubt in my mind, you have listeners right now that are suffering from a substance use disorder or unhealthy substance use behavior. And the message that I want to give to all of them is that there is a solution, that there is hope, that it's going to be scary to reach out for help. It's not going to be pleasant, you know, to change your life, but that the outcomes and the benefits are so strong and that I believe every single person who is suffering can survive and can recover and can build a life worth living. They have to choose a provider who uses science and medicine and compassion combined to really find that path. But I've got faith.
And Nick, what are you up to these days?
Up to these days, it's a total turnaround. So, I mean, I've been sober for 2.5 years, but you know, not only from like just the material, like able to have a house that, I mean, I rent with roommates and having the car back. I had a few DUIs and, you know, I have a great job that has insurance and benefits, you know, the whole works. There's just this spiritual side of it that I've learned through, you know, Gateway provided and as well as, you know, just making it to meetings and trying to see a new like way of life. And I mean, it's a total turnaround from like who I was to who I am today. And I mean, it's amazing. And I mean, if anybody's struggling out there, you should at least try, because I mean, I didn't think there was any hope, and I really struggled being in and out of jails and overdosing, and I didn't think I was going to make it past, honestly, 26. I kind of was telling myself, like, hey, that's it. But, you know, I gave this thing a shot, and I actually gave myself that chance, and I gave that compassion to myself, you know, like, maybe I can't do this, and I saw younger people doing it, so I gave myself that opportunity, and I mean, it's been one hell of a ride, to be honest, and it's been great.
Well, we really appreciate you sharing your story. Best wishes to you. Thank you for being with us. Thanks to Nick and to Dr. Britton. To Dr. Britton's point, if you need help, a number to call is 1-833-2-FIND-HELP. That's 1-833-2-FIND-HELP. Thanks for being with me, gentlemen.
Thanks so much for having us.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. It seems like we vaulted right over spring and straight into summer, which means lots of fun outside, but also lots of opportunities to get bitten by mosquitoes or ticks. We tend to think of mosquito-borne illnesses particularly as something that happens outside the U.S., but actually, according to the CDC, illnesses from mosquitoes, ticks, and fleas have actually tripled in the U.S. between 2004 and 2016. Illinois was also in the top 20% of states for mosquito-borne diseases. With that encouraging statistic, what do you need to know before this summer and what can you do to protect yourself? On the line with me now to discuss this is Dr. Michael Angaroni. He's an assistant professor of medicine and infectious diseases at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Angaroni, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And in studio with me here in Urbana is Marilyn O'Hara Ruiz. She studies vector-borne illnesses spread by mosquitoes and ticks for the Department of Pathobiology at the University of Illinois. Hi, Marilyn. Thanks for being here. Welcome back.
Good morning, Nyla.
And if everyone has questions, by the way, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your questions as well to 21STShow. Dr. Angaroni, can I just start with asking, when we're looking at the number of illnesses and how much that's more than tripled in the past decade, what's behind that?
So, you know, it's unclear exactly what's driving the increased numbers. So some of it is more awareness of these infections. And so when someone presents with a fever in the summer and they've been bitten by a tick or a mosquito, we look for these infections more so than we did 20 years ago. So I think many physicians, just their radar is a little bit more on for looking for these infections. Plus, we've started to identify specific pathogens that were unknown in the past. So many febrile illnesses that are caused by viruses that could be transmitted by mosquitoes or ticks are starting to become recognized a little bit more. I think also there's a thought that people are spending more time outdoors and getting exposed to mosquitoes and ticks a little bit more frequently. And so those are other reasons why we're seeing more of these infections.
Marilyn, if you can remind us the definition of what a vector-borne illness is and which ones are the most dangerous. I mean, I think people have heard about Zika or West Nile. Those tend to get a lot of attention.
Sure, yes. Yeah. So a vector-borne illness is a germ that gets spread by a mosquito, tick, flea, something that transmits it between either two people or sometimes between an animal and a person. And those are called zoonotic diseases when you have that animal host involved in that. So the most common that we have in Illinois in terms of mosquito-borne illnesses is West Nile. So Zika is not really a problem in Illinois, but if you were living in Puerto Rico, for example, there were about 40,000 cases of Zika in 2016. And so that was just an enormous outbreak that pushed those numbers way up for that year. In terms of the tick-borne...
So folks who are traveling to Puerto Rico or maybe other parts of the Caribbean need to be aware of that?
Not so much Zika, but chikungunya and dengue, for example, are ongoing. Zika was really a kind of one-year problem, and it hasn't been something that you see now. So I wouldn't say the danger today is what it was, you know, in 2016. But yes, if you're traveling to a place where you have the nice weather that you want to go to for your vacation, you also should be thinking about what those, you know, potential mosquito-borne diseases might be.
Well, we'll get to those and to those tips in a minute. But back to West Nile and to other things we should be worried about here in Illinois. What specifically are you concerned about?
So here in Illinois, the tick-borne illnesses are especially concerning in that if you look at the numbers here, our numbers are still fairly low. So whereas there might be 30,000 cases of Lyme disease, which is a tick-borne disease, reported in the United States, we only have maybe 300 here in Illinois, but it has been steadily increasing. And so that's where some of the concern is, that it's something that is becoming more of a problem, and we want to, you know, stem that. And then a second concern is what's sometimes it's called Rocky Mountain spotted fever, but there's a general class of illnesses that aren't always very well diagnosed that are similar to Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And we're also seeing an increase in those in Illinois.
And Dr. Angaroni, that's always a particular concern when children are involved and there's a fever. What do parents, other families, caregivers need to know, particularly when we're talking about younger children and tick bites?
So I think for young children, but even for adults, when you see a tick bite, the key is to get the tick off as soon as you identify the tick on the person. And so, you know, if you're in an area where there's a lot of ticks, so if you live in an area that is wooded and you know that when you walk in your yard or if the kids are playing in the park, they're potentially going to get ticks on them, you should do it. Tick check every day to look for any ticks that might be on the body and pull them off as soon as possible. If you're camping or vacationing in an area where you potentially can acquire ticks on your person, you should, again, every day do a thorough tick check. So you have someone look at you, you look at the person that you're with or your children, and you try to pull the ticks off as soon as possible. For Lyme disease, for example, it's thought that it takes over 24 hours for the tick to be attached to actually transmit the infection. And so getting that tick off sooner than waiting, you know, 3 days or 4 days can actually prevent the transmission of Lyme disease. Same thing goes for a lot of the rickettsial infections. The tick may need to be on for shorter periods of time, but the best thing is to get that tick off right away.
And apart from that, if someone has unfortunately not been able to do that, what kind of symptoms in particular do you worry about in terms of needing to seek medical care?
So the symptom that is kind of universal for all the tick infections, and I would even say for the mosquito infections, is a fever. And so if you know that you've been exposed to a tick or you've had multiple mosquito bites and within a day or two you develop a fever of any temperature, you should probably seek medical attention right away. Some of the symptoms that signify the tick-borne infections are typically rashes. So Lyme disease, we get the typical bullseye rash. So it's a rash that's kind of a red circle, but you may have some area in the center that's pale and then the very middle that might be bright red. So it looks almost like a target or a typical target that you think of as being red and white. For Rocky Mountain spotted fever and some of the rickettsial infections, you may get more of a red or purpley spotted rash on the arms or the abdomen or around the area where the tick bite was or on the palms and soles. And so that should prompt you to go get medical attention right away and get started on treatment right away.
And Marilyn, this isn't something you study. This is also something you unfortunately have personal experience with within your family of one of your kids getting Lyme disease.
Yes, that's right. One of my sons had gone camping up in Iowa, and when he returned from the trip, he seemed to be a little sick, but we thought it was just a cold or a flu. And finally, I realized that he was much more ill than I had seen him before. And what had happened with him is he had checked for ticks, and we had talked about that, but he missed the location of the tick was in the middle of his back. And it was a very small tick, and so it wasn't ever seen. We never saw the tick, but we did see the bullseye rash. And he was just extremely sick for several days. Fortunately, we were able to get him treated, and he's fine today.
What tips do you have for folks as they're camping? It sounds like you did everything right. You he was looking for ticks. What do people need to remember, especially as they're outdoors this summer?
I think one of the things that people don't realize is how small some of the ticks are. We think of them as what we see in a picture of a full-grown tick, but the nymphal ticks are actually the most dangerous form, and they're considerably smaller. So I think when we're looking, don't just be looking for a large tick, but also look for something quite small.
So how small?
A little larger than a poppy seed.
Wow, so that's really tiny.
Quite small, yes. So the CDC recently put out a picture of a muffin with poppy seeds on it, and five of them were little tiny ticks.
Oh boy.
And so this hit the internet and people were a little upset, like, oh, look at these poppy seeds. I'll never eat a muffin again. But the point of all of that was to realize just how small.
All right. Look for things that look like poppy seeds. We won't forget that. We will tweet out the picture with them, which my producers tell me is horrifying. Thanks to Marilyn O'Hara Ruiz for being with us at U of I's College of Vet Med, Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, Dr. Michael Angaroni for being with us as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Have a good day.
That does it for us today. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for tuning in. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information. You can also always follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21stshow. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.